Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
It's Wednesday, the 23rd of December, 2020, and you're listening to Reconstruction with me, David Taylor, editor of the Construction Index magazine, and Phil Bishop, editor of our daily online news service. We've taken a short break from our goose stuffing, pudding stirring, tree dressing, festive chores to share with you some memories of 2020, a year which it is fair to say has had its ups and downs. Well, we're here, Phil. Are you in festive mood yet?
I am, actually. Although you talk about more ups and downs. I think there'll be more downs this year, haven't they, I'm afraid to say. But we're up at the moment. We're up and ready for Christmas Day.
Yeah, I think so. You've got to end on a high, haven't you? Well, anyway, here we are. I thought, obviously, there is one dominant theme to this year. And I don't need to mention what it is. We all know what it is. And it has tended to overshadow some of the other events that have taken place. So I think our plan, and let's hope it works out, is that we'll sort of go through in roughly chronological order and sort of register a few of the highs and lows, shall we, Phil? Do you want to start off? How did the year start for you anyway?
Year started for me with the Reconstruction podcast we started in January. Yeah. We've been doing Well, it's the back end of January, 23rd of January, we did our first podcast, you and I, David.
And seems like yesterday.
We had a few weeks off in the summer, went fortnightly for a couple of months, but we've been a constant, and I thank people who've been with us, listening to us throughout the year. But if you remember, I mean, in January, it all... Our whole focus at that point, I think, you know, we were aware that something was coming round the corner from Wuhan, but we didn't really know what was going to happen to us. And we were still thinking about, of course, in January, we officially left the European Union, and we had a new government had recently come in, and there was all sorts of economic uncertainty on that basis and political uncertainty on that basis. And that was what was going on. And the other big thing that we knew about at the start of the year, which has been a continuing theme of the year and will continue to be a theme for the next several years, is the whole topic of climate emergency. We became very, very familiar with a Swedish schoolgirl who brought it to consciousness for a lot of people who may not have been quite so conscious of the extent of the climate emergency. And the construction industry is, well, talk about, I suppose, briefly today, has stepped up to the plate on this with all sorts of
certainly has, hasn't it?
Policy initiatives, yes.
So I looked at the first issue of the year. I consider it to be the first issue. It's the February issue of the year. The big picture feature in the magazine, I don't even remember that, was an aerial shot of dozens of excavators on a brownfield site in Wuhan, desperately shifting earth in order to build the first hospital. And we marvelled at that. Funnily enough, following the events of this year, looking back at that picture now, we thought it was a wonderful show of everybody pulling together and sort of a shared enterprise sort of thing. Now it just smacks of desperation. There are all these, every single excavator in Wuhan had been drafted in, and they're crowding onto this site to shift earth. You wouldn't do an earth moving job like that under any other circumstances. These were emergency measures, but it was certainly a really striking image.
Well, you say that, but a lot of Chinese infrastructure has been built like that. I mean, I don't have the numbers to hand, but if you ever read statistics about the amount of railway line and motorway that has been built in China in very short order, I mean, they build big things quickly and lots of it.
Yeah, well, they do. You're quite right there. I can't argue with that. And we were marvelling at that, but it was only a couple of months later than we started doing it ourselves and started building these Nightingale hospitals around the country.
Which was impressive, but very different, of course.
Yes, because we were using either existing facilities and just putting in the medical equipment and stuff like that, or we were using modular accommodation, sort of mobile huts and that kind of thing.
Well, there are a couple of let's go back to some of the stories we're talking about at the beginning of the inn. One in particular that comes out, a story in February we wrote about, was the Court of Appeal ruling that the Heathrow third runway, effectively ruling that Heathrow third runway could not go ahead. It basically, the Court of Appeal backed a challenge brought by campaign groups Friends of the Earth and Plan B to say that the government's airport national policy statement, the government policy upon which Heathrow expansion is predicated and depends, the campaign group said that this government policy statement was effectively illegal because it didn't take account of government's commitments to the Paris Agreement on climate change. The Court of Appeal basically said, you're right, the airport national policy statement document is invalid. Heathrow didn't like the Court of Appeal's ruling, went to the Supreme Court, and right at the end of the year, Supreme Court says, Heathrow, as you were, go ahead. The airport national policy statement of the government, the government's policy, is okay. We don't have a problem with it. And it basically kicked the environmental campaign group's argument into touch. Which, of course, won't be the end of it, because it's hard to imagine Heathrow wanting to build a third runway terribly quickly at the moment. But it puts it all back in play, and the fight will continue. We still now yet have the prospect of our Prime Minister lying in front of the bulldozers like he almost promised indeed to do. Which would give some of the campaign groups, I think, an interesting dilemma. Do they want the bulldozers to stop or keep going?
Yes, that's a very good point. And, of course, Boris Johnson, he's got a foot in both camps now. Well, I mean, obviously he's the Prime Minister. It's his government's policy. So he's got his Hendon constituents to think about. They want him to lie down in front of
Hendon?
The bulldozers.
No, he's Uxbridge.
Is it Hillingdon?
He's Uxbridge.
Oh, Uxbridge is it. Sorry, I knew it was somewhere west of London, or West London.
Well, Hendon's north.
Oh, yes. Yeah, so should he lie down in front of the bulldozers, or should he actually be driving one of them? Because
Well, no, the government's neutral on it. The government is studiously avoiding taking a position. It has its policy statement on airports, but it didn't seek to appeal the Court of Appeal's judgment back in February, and it's going to be a private. It's no government money into the Heathrow Airport expansion, supposedly. As far as the government is saying, hey, that's up to the private sector to do what they want.
This whole climate change issue has, as you mentioned earlier, really taken off this year, and in fact, it's surprising how wholeheartedly tier one contractors have bought into all this, because some of them are coming out. It seems not a week goes by that we don't hear from another top contractor about its zero carbon commitments. And there have been some very ambitious targets declared this year, haven't they? Lendlease saying that it will be net zero carbon by 2025, for example,
which is a huge target. I mean,
it's certainly one to watch.
Wilmot, yes. Dixon going by, I think, 2030 or 2040 was theirs. Other people have been saying 2040, but we're still going to do offsetting, carbon offsetting, pay our way out of jail, basically. But Lendlease, you know, no diesel on sites by 2025, which is...
That is incredible, isn't it?
I don't think they're going to be able to do it. Maybe their own, but I don't think Lendlease actually themselves pour much diesel. It's down the supply chain, and that might be their get out. I mean, their intention, the supply chain won't be using diesel at all by 2025. That's the goal. I don't think they can achieve it. But good luck to them.
Well, I can't see how they could. I mean, there are ways of fudging these things, of course, because, you mentioned the obvious one is carbon offsetting, because you can emit as much carbon as you like as long as you pay somebody to plant trees to absorb it all again. And that is always the sort of backstop position. You could always do that. But, you know, you could say we're not going to have any diesel on site. I don't know how you'd enforce it anyway. I mean, maybe you just wouldn't get any work done if you tried to do that. Well, I think it's fairly unreasonable.
Although it's interesting that...
Unrealistic.
Lendlease projects tend to be, my impression is, I regard them as more of a builder than a civil engineer, and their projects tend to be urban, where there is an electricity source to plug into. I don't associate Lend-Lease with road building or you know, civil engineering works in the middle of nowhere where you need earth movers with nowhere to plug them in. Perhaps for Lend-Lease, it might be a more achievable target to get rid of diesel than for someone who's more into civil engineering, a Bam Nuttall, for example, someone like that.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. But it's interesting you should mention that because, of course, another theme of this year has been electric plant. That seems to be taking off very rapidly now. We did a piece in the magazine just last month about JCB's launch of its latest electric telehandler and site dumper. And there's talk about other alternative sources of energy like hydrogen and ammonia as well. I don't know anything about ammonia, but apparently it can be used as an alternative fuel source. That's quite interesting. We also did a feature in the magazine back in the summer about a skid steer, which is being manufactured in the Czech Republic and imported, just come over into the UK, which is claimed to be the first all-electric skid steer loader with remarkably old-fashioned technology. It's powered by a lead-acid battery.
Oh.
You know, it's not like a Tesla or anything like that. It's fairly sort of fairly old-fashioned technology. But of course, the manufacturer or the importer of this device makes the very valid point that actually a lead-acid battery is ideal for a skid steer loader because you don't want rapid acceleration in a skid steer loader, but you do want an awful lot of mass. So if you've got a great big lead-acid battery sitting on the back of the machine, then it's actually going to be better than a lithium-ion battery, which doesn't really weigh anything. So that machine apparently has caused quite a stir in the industry, not just in construction either, but in other industries such as agriculture and even ports and docks and that kind of thing, where it's used for clearing out the holds of bulk carriers and things like that. So electric plant seems to be something which is definitely got a very strong future. JCB, as I mentioned earlier, released a couple of more machines, as well as a hydrogen prototype excavator this year. And they promise lots more to come. So that'll be another thing to watch for next year.
Well, what I'm interested in is we've had, whether it's battery-powered or plug-in, small plant for a while now, it seems.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the big stuff. And I know some of the excavator manufacturers, I think JCB, their hydrogen-powered machine's on the test bed. It's only a prototype, I think, at the moment. Is it 20-tonne or a 16-tonne or something?
It's a proper size one.
But bigger than that is the Leap Air crawler crane that we've talked about.
Yes.
Which is a huge, great thing, battery-powered, lithium-ion. I mean, you mentioned lead acid battery as having the advantage of mass, that it gives ballast and weight to a machine, which something like a skid steer needs to stay stable. But they don't have the performance, is my understanding. They need recharging too often, I think, don't they?
Compared
to lithium ion. My understanding is that lithium ion is a more efficient, much more efficient battery. You know, run all day on a charge and you can recharge them much more quickly. And to support this, the construction angle for us is not just the machines that batteries are powering. ISG is about to start building a lithium-ion battery factory up in Blyth in Northumberland. That starts in, I don't know if it's in the spring, but it won the contract just the other week. And that's a huge project. They're saying it's the biggest thing since Nissan came to the Northeast. It's that scale of development. Huge, great project.
Moving on, what else caught your eye later on in the year, Phil?
Well, we're desperately trying to avoid COVID conversation, aren't we? I think another running story through the year, which we've dipped in and out of, has been the whole business of smart motorways, whether they're smart or not, can argue about. But earlier in the year, the government, on the back of a Panorama TV programme, which highlighted some of the problems with the road safety problems with smart motorways, the government was effectively forced to suspend the rollout of the smart motorway programme. For those who aren't familiar with the term smart motorway, instead of widening motorways or building new motorways, what the current plan is, and it's been going on for a few years now, is turn the hard shoulder into an extra running lane. So you get rid of the hard shoulder and you put in overhead gantries and lots of wires and electric signboards and technology that monitors where the traffic's flowing. And you can, if it starts getting a bit chocky, you can flash up a sign saying speed limit's now 60 miles an hour or 40 miles an hour or whatever. So the smart bit is that the...
Which, of course, everybody ignores.
I don't know, they do, because there are also cameras everywhere. So they don't need policing in the old-fashioned sense. They're self-policing. Well, that's the idea. We've since discovered a lot of the detection technology. The technology is supposed to be able to detect when a car's broken down in the middle of the road. And the rescue services are, you know, in like Flynn within supposedly 10 minutes or something to help you and get the road moving again. And we learnt this year that actually hardly any of the detection technology has actually gone in. So it's all been a bit bogus. And by the end of the year, it's all back rolling out again. Smart motorways are going much the same as they ever had been in the first place. There's some talk of putting in more, what do they call them, refuge zones, but sort of the modern equivalent of a hard shoulder, the little lay-by where you can, if you think you're about to break down, you can pull in there. But at one point, it looked like there was going to be a real rethink of smart motorways, but Highways England, the Department of Transport, had gone too far down that road. And I've said to you before, I'm convinced that there's a hidden agenda, which no one will admit to, that within short order, it will be a automatic toll collection system. The technology that's going in for smart motorways will be used for road tolls, for
road pricing,
automatic collection, road pricing, which is why they have to pursue. No one will confirm that, but that's my take on it.
It would make sense because, of course, if we're going to be moving to all electric cars by, when is it, 2030? There won't be any diesel or cars sold.
Yeah.
The government's going to lose an awful lot of fuel duty, aren't they?
Yeah.
So they're not going to get the tax income from diesel and petrol, so they'll have to get it from somewhere else. And it makes perfect sense to start road pricing instead and get the revenue that way.
I mean, we're already seeing, certainly in London, you have to drive into London. Do other cities have what they call a congestion charge?
Ultra low.
Do you have to pay to get into Cambridge, for example, or somewhere else? I don't know if other cities have yet got entry fees for motorists.
But do you know what? I don't know that. I don't know the answer to that question.
Yes,
certainly London does. I mean, London is highly regulated. It's got the congestion charge. It's got the ultra low emission zone. And that's why all the Uber drivers in London drive. In fact, a friend of mine recently got an Uber and it was a Tesla because, of course, they're buzzing in and out of the centre of London all the time. And if you're in a fossil fuel burning car, you're going to pay loads and loads of money in charges just to operate and do your business in London. So you have to, it's worth investing in an expensive all electric car because it's an upfront cost, but your running cost will be much, much lower.
We've seen quite a few construction companies this year invest in, I think, did FM Conway and was it Speedy?
Yes.
And I can't remember who else have all been.
FM Conway had that electric bike, which you can put a pallet of bricks on the front.
Yeah,
looks really, really quite dodgy, but apparently it's not. It's all tested and perfectly stable, but 200 kilograms of bricks on the front of a bike, rather you than me. But no, Speedy and somebody else, I can't remember who exactly it was, they've been experimenting with these electric London taxis, haven't they?
That's right.
To do...
Yeah. Small delivery vehicles.
That's right, yeah. So they're delivering machinery, you know, tools and equipment around to their sites in London using these things. It's a trial at the moment. I don't think it's actually a commercial thing. They're participating in tests. But anyway, I suppose it will cut your costs eventually if you're going to do that. Getting back to your question about whether or not other cities have similar restrictions on diesel and petrol cars, I don't know. And I'm sure our listeners will tell us if we're wrong.
Oh,
I don't think there are any.
Sorry to interrupt. Talking of things
That's
we
right.
don't know, We were speaking a couple of weeks ago about the playbook, the construction playbook that the government published about procurement. And you asked me, who is the government minister for procurement? And as someone who likes to think I'm moderately on top of these things, I was ashamed to admit that didn't have a clue. So I went away and looked it up, and I forgot to tell you this last week when we were talking. I went away and looked it up, and it's not surprising I didn't know. It's someone I've never heard of. Lord Agnew, apparently. Theodore Agnew, who got a seat in the House of Lords a couple of years ago, whether it's because he gave money to the Tory party or whether that was an added bonus. But, Lord Agnew, I don't think he's any relation to the Agnew that I'm more familiar with, Aggers. He's government procurement minister. So
really? I've never heard of him.
I feel no shame in not knowing that now.
Hmm. What's his background? Do you know?
I did Google him. Wikipedia says he was a farmer who went into finance, banking, venture, or other. Yeah, money.
Usually happens the other way around, doesn't it? Yeah, okay. Right, so he's in charge of procurement. Right, okay. March had some quite notable stories.
Well, it's the budget of course.
Yes, indeed. So what's your take on that one?
We were expecting the National Infrastructure Strategy. We had to wait however many more, 7 or 8 months more till that came out. That didn't come out till the autumn, finally, in the autumn statement. But the big story for the budget, this is just before the really big event of March, which we can't avoid for much longer.
No.
Budget middle of March, it already looked like the virus was going to really hurt the country. And this was Rishi Sunak implanted himself upon public consciousness by being rather dashing and promising us lots and lots and lots of money and public spending going everywhere.
He'd only been in post for a few weeks, hadn't he, by the time this happened?
Yes, the previous chap had been ousted because he wasn't allowed to keep his own advisers. Dominic Cummings said, that advisor of yours is going to have to go. Her face doesn't fit. Sajid Javid said, well, I'm not having you telling me who I can hire, you non-elected advisor yourself. Sajid Javid went, and in came Rishi Sunak, who had been chief secretary. He'd been the deputy in the Treasury.
Yes. Yeah.
And he stepped up. It was thought that he was, the way he came into the job, it seemed like it was a number 10 Downing Street power grab, and he was going to be Boris's poodle. It since seems that it's almost the other way around. It's rather felt throughout the past year that Rishi Sunak has been rather more important, authoritative and decisive than the Prime Minister.
Yeah. That doesn't surprise me. I mean, Boris Johnson has never struck me as being a particularly decisive person. You know, he has to check which way the wind's blowing before he makes a decision. No, Rishi Sunak, again, somebody whose name was not familiar to a very large number of people in the country, I should think, until he actually became Chancellor. All of a sudden, he was he was a golden boy, wasn't he? Because he announced these certainly unprecedented unprecedented measures to support the economy during the lockdown. This included the furlough scheme and the self-employed income support scheme, which has been a lifesaver for a lot of people in the construction industry.
Well, they of course came in after the other big event.
This was
The budget. Was it the 22nd, 23rd of March, something like that? The Prime Minister went on national TV saying we're all going into national lockdown, which really kicked things off.
Yes, that was a watershed moment, wasn't it? We're rather used now to having our freedoms curtailed, not being able to meet more than a certain number of people in certain locations under particular conditions. Before that, this was a free country. You could meet whoever you wanted, whenever you wanted, wherever you wanted. And all of a sudden, there was Boris Johnson on the television one Monday evening telling us we couldn't go out of the house unless we actually had to. Absolutely had to.
But this isn't
something which we'd...
But this isn't the only curtailment of freedom, it seems to me, that we've been experiencing in 2020. There's been an awful lot of debate, if we steer away from our own construction industry interests for a moment. The whole issue which, to what extent school teachers and university lecturers should be allowed to say what they want and put put arguments, unfashionable arguments forward to their, not just to their pupils, but whether authors are allowed to say things which people might not agree with. That the concept of not just freedom of movement and freedom of assembly that we've lost through COVID, the concept of freedom of speech, it seems to me, is, I probably shouldn't say, I don't know if I want to say it's under threat, but it's certainly being redefined, which is a new development worthy of greater exploring than anyone dare say.
Yeah.
I mean, I know myself.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, we haven't discussed what a lot of people would call the cancel culture or the woke agenda, because it hasn't really been relevant to our discussions on this podcast in the past. And it is only, well, I was going to say, it's only peripherally significant to the construction industry, but that's not strictly true. A lot of issues which are associated with the sort of the woke agenda have been not merely acknowledged, but acknowledged and adopted or accepted by the construction industry in general. And I'm thinking things like Black Lives Matter, LGBTQ rights, that kind of thing. Construction is often regarded as being a very sort of reactionary and old-fashioned conservative with a small C or a big C industry that has no truck with fashionable trends such as this. But a lot of the main contractors have gone out of their way to get behind movements such as Black Lives Matter and LGBTQ rights.
Well, construction has been well represented at Pride marches, for example, for many years. And I don't think anything new. I think the thing to remember that if you say that the construction industry is, well, I used to think it was 10%, it's about 7% of the economy now, and it employs directly about 1.5 million people, and you can probably multiply that by three indirectly. That with that amount of people and that chunk of the country involved in construction, every shade and opinion, type, trope, person, I think, is in there. All life is here. So I think it's long been a bit, you know, tired to say all construction's reactionary or old fashioned or whatever. I think the accusations that you can make are the same that you can make at any business. I mean, business will always tend to put money first, because if it doesn't put money first, it can't employ people and do the good things it wants to do.
But anyway, that's wandering slightly off the beaten track there.
That's what we do. That's what we do, though, David.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, we mentioned the start of lockdown, end of March, last week of March, and the construction industry, by and large, went, oh, we've got to stay at home. And we all learnt to, we learnt what Zoom was, another word of the year.
Yes.
there was the hashtag shut the sites. So those construction sites that didn't shut the doors, they were under an awful lot of social media pressure to shut the sites. And it seemed like everything shut down for at least a week. Those sites that worked out how to implement social distancing and hand washing routines and so on site started to open. But it probably wasn't till the end of April where the construction industry was thought of getting back up to speed. I mean, I think we reported at one stage, I can't remember what the percentage of people went on furlough was, but something like 50% of the industry were on furlough at one stage for a few weeks.
Yeah.
By the end of April, most of the major construction sites were back, but the house builders took rather longer because, of course, no one was buying houses, so there was no great rush to get things finished off. But there was certainly a month where the construction is shut down, and we've reported on the statistics for construction output. It didn't entirely go off a cliff, but it fell something like 50%, I think, from the top of my head. You would have thought it would have fallen 100%, absolutely nothing, by looking out your window, but there was always stuff going on. But a 50% fall month on month in construction output was catastrophic. And it looked like it was going to get really, really messy. And I've got in front of me something that I wrote in March when the sites shut down, when it was after the Chancellor had promised all this money for furlough and self-employed people's support. And I wrote, despite a level of state intervention unprecedented since the Second World War, it seems inevitable that many construction companies will topple over the brink. It's going to be a very messy couple of years ahead.
Hmm.
That's what I said then.
Voice of doom.
That's what I said then, but I'm delighted to say it shows that I know absolutely nothing. It has not happened. Now, no. I don't want to underplay the difficulties still facing many people, many individuals, many companies. But by and large, in the construction industry at least, we appear to be getting off okay, don't we?
Well, compared to things like hospitality and entertainments, most certainly. Because, I mean, if you remember, to begin with, there was an exemption, wasn't there, for essential work. So, I don't know, I suppose that was things like the Tideway project and road repairs and things like that, rather than house building and, you know, building new offices. So there was a trickle of construction work carrying on uninterrupted because of that. And yet all the theatres, cinemas, sports venues all closed down, and most of them have remained closed ever since. You know, the pubs and bars and restaurants have been open, shut, slightly open, takeaway only. They've been messed around like nobody's business for the rest of the year. So compared with that, construction has really come off lightly because most non-essential construction work can now take place. I don't know of any sites personally that have still remained shut because of COVID restrictions. I think everything is... You know, the industry very quickly found a way to operate. The new, you know, the operating procedures which the Construction Leadership Council published and revised repeatedly seem to have done the trick. People abided by them. They gave them a license to operate in a way. Here are the procedures. Stick to that and you can work. And people managed to do it.
The number of firms that have gone bust this year in 2020... seems to be a lot fewer than in 2019. Now, that could be... I could imagine there are companies that would have gone bust in 2020 had it not been for the support schemes that Rishi Sunak's made available because of COVID. So I have a theory that COVID has actually saved some businesses.
Now, that's an interesting theory,
You look at, in 2019, look at these names that went down in 2019. Clugston, Bardsley, Shaler, Podchins, Hawke, Aspin, Dornoth, Paragon Interiors, Simons Group. Interserve went into administration in 2019, don't forget. Came up under ownership of its banks. This year, I had a little look at who people report on going to administration. Cruden, Astin, the dry lining firm, Harry Fairclough, Central Building Contractors in Glasgow. I mean, that's four firms who've gone, who, you know, prefer not to, of course. But it seems less corporate carnage there in 2020 than in 2019. So,
yes, that is counterintuitive. You certainly wouldn't expect that. And I think you could be excused for your doom and gloom expressed back in March because... You know, if you remember what it was like back then, we had no idea how people would cope. Nobody really knew how they would cope. We just had to muddle through.
But a lot of contractors had big debt burden at the outset.
Yes.
And a lot of their debt has come down because they've not been spending money. But the projects have slowed down. The materials aren't there. And so the debt burden of the industry, my impression is, has reduced.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay.
Material shortage continues to be a theme of the year, and that's going to continue into the new year as well.
Yes.
Initially, it was all because of the supply chain around the world. Factories were shutting around the world, stopping manufacturing parts and tools and materials that were needed for our construction projects. And this has been coupled, of course, with suddenly we can't get ships into from Calais into Dover. The boats aren't getting through, or the lorries aren't getting through, which is making things a bit tricky at the minute. Of course, one of the other big events of the year for the construction industry was the official start of HS2.
Oh, yes.
Which is the biggest project, live project, that the UK construction industry has got going at the moment.
That took me a bit by surprise, I have to confess. Well, I thought HS2 had already been given the go-ahead and already started.
Well, it had been given lots of go-aheads, of course, but Boris Johnson was, when he came in as Prime Minister, it was thought that he might not be, it wasn't clear how keen he was on it. He prefers garden bridges and islands in the Thames Estuary and tunnels to Scotland and to Scotland from Scotland to Ireland and things like that. But it was in February that he stood up and said, "Yep, go ahead for HS2." It wasn't until the autumn, September, when he donned a high-vis jacket and hard hat and visited the site and said, "I hereby declare work starting." Of course, he'd been off sick for some of the spring, and it had all been a bit difficult getting things going with the whole COVID protocols. Although work had been going on the HS2 project for some years, I mean, Euston particularly, the enabling works there that
had been going on,
a lot of demolition work and so on has been on for ages, but the official start of works was declared in September 2020. October 2020, it was revealed that the project was already £400 million over budget.
Yeah.
So that may be a recurring theme, of course.
Well, yes, I'm sure there'll be further announcements of a similar nature, because mega projects like this nearly always go over budget. I can think of very few that haven't. So that was no surprise. I mean, as you say, it was rather a ceremonial announcement rather than a genuine go-ahead when Boris Johnson said work can now start. This is on the first phase, main contract.
Well, the contract hadn't officially been signed off. I mean, all the contractors were in place and ready to go, but the actual legal sign-off had to take place.
Yes, yeah. Should we talk a bit about the magazine, Phil?
Yeah, go ahead.
I mean, I don't know if you've been reading the magazine this year. We haven't had quite as many issues out as I would have liked. We've had to...
But we've kept going. A lot of magazines have, of course, stopped paper publication, not just this year, but in recent years. And I think Construction Index magazine, well done to you, Dave, and your team there for keeping it alive and kicking. It's more
thanks
than
also
kicking.
To our publisher for keeping faith with it. We've had to go bi-monthly. We're currently bi-monthly. And we'll be for the foreseeable future, though if there's an upturn, then hopefully we'll go back to our regular monthly publication. I mean, we've had some interesting features in there, not as many as we would normally have, of course. And so the highlights are few and far between.
Shall I tell you my favourite feature in your magazine this year? Croft Quarry.
Yeah, now, well, we had...
Richard Dolman came on the podcast to talk to us about that, didn't he?
Yes, indeed. Yes, AR Demolition at Croft Quarry up in Leicestershire. They've been doing a lot of work up there. This was the first of the stories about Croft Quarry, of course, which was that they drafted in a 1918 vintage steam engine to winch a bit of old quarry equipment up a steep slope, because it would have cost an awful lot more to hire a modern diesel winch. And an afternoon or whatever.
It was dragging a conveyor belt from out of down a shaft, wasn't it, from underground?
That's right. Oh, yes, that's right. Yes.
Lots of steelwork.
So it was, I suppose, a tricky job. But once you'd worked out how you were going to do it, wouldn't take very long. And, of course, the cost of the hiring special equipment for that was a bit eye-watering, according to Richard. But one of his colleagues at AR Demolition is a steam enthusiast, as indeed is Richard himself. He's caught the steam bug himself, apparently. And they've got this beautiful old steam engine, a traction engine, with a winch fitted to it. And so they just parked it up at the top, attached a wire rope to this conveyor, and off they went. And all the while in the firebox, they had some they had a joint of beef and a gammon.
That's
roasting.
Right. He told
and so
us
they
that.
had I thought that was fantastic. So yes, that was a good story. Yeah, quite an interesting company and an interesting approach to problem solving as well.
What was your favourite feature of the magazines this year?
Well, mine was a more recent one, actually. It was, I thought it was interesting because I'd never heard of this company before. And it's a company which is very well known in its own sphere, which isn't really construction. It's a company called Unusual Rigging. And it's a very aptly named organisation. It's a company that does theatre rigging and rigging for special events. I mean, big events like
Olympics,
London 2012 Olympics, yeah. That kind of thing. It does, you know, spectaculars, basically. And it's all about, you know, it's a high wire act. It's about lots of chain hoists, wire ropes, shackles, slings, pulleys, that kind of thing. And their speciality is obviously suspending lighting, special effects, scenery, and people, as it happens. And they are well known. The company founder, a man called Alan Jacoby, was very well connected in the world of theatre and rock and roll. I mean, he was mates with the Rolling Stones and people like that, you know, because he'd gone on tour with them, presumably. And he was a very colourful character. And the company has, throughout its history, it's been going for well over 30 years, I think. Throughout its history, it's been doing work for construction clients, sort of on, you know, a bit here, a bit there, but it's in such demand from the theatrical and entertainment sector that it's never really had to get into doing construction work in any big way. And you can see why. I mean, one of its biggest and most certainly an impressive job for the construction industry was a job it did for Mace at Birmingham New Street Station. It suspended a work platform above the concourse of the station so that work could be carried out on the roof and the station could still operate as normal. I mean, otherwise you would have had to fill the entire concourse with scaffolding and that would have completely interfered with normal operations. Fantastic job, but it also did the 2012 Olympics. It was going to do the Olympics this year in Tokyo, which of course got postponed. And of course, far more glamorous even than Birmingham New Street Station. So that's the sort of work that it did. And it was, you know, it's a go-to rigging specialist for showbiz. But again, COVID-19 hit, all the theatres closed, the Tokyo Olympics were postponed. Basically, its entire workload just stopped.
It just went.
The company decided that, well, hang on a second, construction is still working. And so they've decided that they want to focus more on construction. They've realised, actually, that they do need another string to their bow and that construction, they can do some very clever things for construction firms, for contractors. And so they're focusing on that again. And they've been doing more work this year in the construction sector. I thought a rather poignant coda to this piece actually was the fact that Alan Jacoby, the founder of this company, actually died this year, I think in April. Yes, on the 13th of April 2020. He'd been ill with cancer for some time, but he died in April, which must have been, you know, absolutely devastating for the company because, you know, your founder, your spiritual leader, if you like.
Lose your leader and your market all at the same time.
And yeah, exactly. Yeah, terrible. But yeah, good luck to them. Fascinating company.
A bit of trivia for you about that universe. Do you know the difference between, or how to spot the difference between a wire rope hoist used in construction or industrial applications and then a wire rope hoist used in entertainment applications?
Wow, that's a very arcane question, Phil. I'm not sure. Wire hoist is a wire rope hoist, as far as I'm concerned. No, you're going to have to tell me that one because I can't even guess.
Well, in industrial applications, if you see a wire rope hoist, the box which houses the motor and the coiled up rope will be at the top, where and the hook will be at the bottom. Whereas in entertainment applications, they fix the hook to the ceiling and the box goes up and down.
Ah. And is there a reason
There's
for that?
There's a very good reason for it.
Which is?
Can't remember.
Fantastic. Well, that's a real anticlimax, isn't it, Phil? Thank you for that. No, that was probably my favourite feature of the year in the magazine. There were others. We wrote something early in the year, which I'd almost forgotten about, actually, about another topic which I'm quite interested in, because I think it's just a little bit off the wall, which was the use of hemp in construction.
Oh, yes.
Which isn't a new thing. I mean, it's been used. Hemp fibre is, they call it shiv, actually. It's not the fibre, not the stuff they turn into rope or cloth. It's the hard, woody, fibrous stuff on the inside, I think, which they use. It's used for reinforcing lime mixes, and it can be, you can make blocks out of it. You can use it almost like concrete to build walls. And it has, obviously, hemp actually has become a very trendy substance. I mean, obviously, when we talk about hemp, people tend to think of two things, rope and reefers. And when I'm talking about reefers, I'm not talking about reefing sails in on
You're
a ship.
Talking
I'm
talking spliff.
About, I'm talking spliffs. So hemp, cannabis sativa. That's, of course, what most people think about. But it's a wonder plant, you know. You can now buy hemp oil in your supermarket because it's incredibly healthy and far better for you than, say, peanut oil in your salad dressings, that kind of thing. It's a wonder plant. You can use it for all sorts of things. Yeah, there's a company called Unite Hemp, which is growing loads and loads of hemp, acres of hemp. In fact, I think I'll have to touch base with them again because it's almost a year since I spoke to them last.
And you're getting low.
They were planning... Yeah, that's right. But they were planning a huge increase in the amount of hemp they were going to grow this year because they saw this as a building material with a very bright future. I haven't heard anything from them since February, so I don't know whether they have been a victim of COVID, whether or not the hemp harvest hasn't been particularly bountiful this year. But I thought that was quite an interesting one as well.
There's one story we haven't mentioned, which was quite a big deal, I think, for the one sector of the construction industry this year, which is A-Plant as a name,
oh, yes,
as a brand, is no longer. The company is still there, of course, and Ashtead, the parent company,
yeah,
is still there. But it's no more A-Plant. Goodbye, A-Plant. Hello, Sunbelt. We've discussed
Sunbelt
this before. But
yes.
Sunbelt is the new name in plant hire, or a new name plant, but the new name for A-Plant, which was a bit of a surprise.
I haven't really thought of it from this point of view before, but A-Plant sounds very British. I mean, I think we're probably the only nation on earth that refers to construction equipment as plant. A-Plant sounds really British, and Sunbelt sounds quintessentially American, doesn't it? I mean, Sunbelt, I think it must be somewhere in Texas or
Sunbelt was,
Miami.
Sunbelt was exactly around where, I think, the southern states of the US was a rental company,
yeah,
that Ashtead bought.
Yes. And it rapidly
15,
became the biggest part of their business.
Yeah, because plant hire, as we know it in this country, was quite immature as a business in the US when Ashtead moved in. I guess they were, can't deny that they were smart, but I think even more than smart, they were lucky. Their timing was fantastic.
Yes.
And they rode the and helped drive the creation or the growth of proliferation of plant hire in the US market. And Sunbelt USA is something like 10 times the size, I think, of
yes,
Sunbelt A-Plant as was in the UK. Much bigger, much more profitable, higher margins and so on. They've now got Sunbelt Canada as well. The acquisition, the change of name of A-Plant was simply a consolidation of the Ashtead brands, really, it seems to me. But
yes, there wasn't any fundamental change in the company itself, apart from its identity, really. I mean, they didn't
purely marketing,
they didn't change,
I think,
the management structure or the but the renaming of the company was announced early in the year, and it didn't happen until June. Now, why was that?
Well, no, they announced it in February or something, and it was going to happen on May 1st was the switchover, because it takes time to get everything, there's an awful lot, thousands of
print,
signs.
All those and, letterheads.
Well,
yes.
Not just that, it's the machines have all got painting on them, the vans.
Yes.
All the staff all wear liveried uniforms. So they all had to get new, you know, T-shirts and jackets and whatever. And so it took time. And in the event, it took a month longer. It wasn't until June that it was the official name change took place because of, but it's blamed on COVID. I have no reason to doubt it. It slowed things down there. June, yeah. Of course, was a mention of we first heard Boris Johnson say "build, build, build" in his most Churchillian. Remember the "build, build, build" speech? Which,
well, I do, because I mean it was very quickly revised, wasn't it, to "build back better." I don't know. Was that always planned? There was some criticism of "build, build, build," wasn't there, from environmental groups who saw this took this to mean that we were going to concrete over the countryside, and that "build, build, build" wasn't necessarily a good thing.
Well, there was a relaxation of the planning rules that went hand in hand with it, didn't it? The extension permitted development rights, and this new algorithm, which thankfully they seem to have gone back to the drawing board with slightly, which was supposed to level up the north by concreting over the south, which I didn't quite get.
So, Phil, have you any idea what the most popular stories have been on the website this year?
Well, I can tell you that the story which attracted the most attention, with 122,700 views, was it was just before the March budget, when there was speculation, which proved correct, that the rebate for red diesel was about to be out.
Oh, yes.
End of the road for red diesel. And it was only a week before, when I think it was either the BBC or the Financial Times or someone with a degree of credibility said, looks like Rishi Sunak's axing the red diesel rebate. Construction industry went, yikes, and started lobbying and writing letters to the Treasury saying, could you cancel your budget, please, and stop and think again, like 7 days before, which was not going to happen. Fortunately, the farmers were talking and saying the same thing, and he managed to get it watered down for the farmers, being able to keep their red diesel rebate. For construction, it wasn't going to come in straight away or even in 2021, as feared. It was put back till April 2022, I think, isn't it? The red diesel rebate is going.
Yes, that's still the deadline, isn't it?
That's still happening, I believe, unless I've reported something subsequently, which I've forgotten. So a lot of interest in the issue of the red diesel rebate. And as you can imagine, throughout the COVID, early days of the COVID crisis, an awful lot of interest in a lot of the developments relating to site operating procedures and so on attracted a lot of interest, and who's supposed to be on site and who's not supposed to be on site. The other story which has been attracting a lot of attention is the impending IR35 tax changes, which are coming in next year. They were going to come in April 2021, managed to get them put back to April 2022. Sorry, I beg your pardon. They were supposed to come in April 20.
Yeah, I was going to say.
They've been put back to April 2021. Yes. And there are hopes that they might be able to get, you know, people are still trying to push for another year's delay on that, or even forget about it altogether.
It is pretty unpopular, isn't it, in the construction industry, that IR35 thing, because it's to do with VAT, isn't it, basically, that you will no longer, you'll pay your VAT direct to HMRC, it won't be collected, it will be collected? No, it won't be collected by your clients and then passed on, you pay it directly to the HMRC.
One of the big problems with it, and there are all sorts of big problems, one of the big problems that the main contractors won't have that extra 20% of cash going through their books that they use for a month, for whatever, 3 months before they have to give it back to the Chancellor. So it's that's a big thing coming down the line. But that didn't happen in 2020, and maybe finally we can end on three other things that didn't happen in 2020, which we thought would happen. Crossrail didn't open.
No.
Costain didn't finish its A465 widening, road widening job in the Brecon Beacons that it was meant to finish in September 2018. And not much flammable cladding got replaced on tower blocks.
No, that's true. So three rather shameful things.
Hope movement in all three of those happens in 2021.
Well, it's Christmas Eve tomorrow, and really we should be doing other things. I don't know why we're sitting here talking about construction. We've got some festivities to get stuck into.
Have you got me anything?
No, I haven't, Phil. You don't expect a Christmas present from me, do you? Never had one from you.
I expect nothing but live in hope. Well, I have bought you, David, you'll be happy to know, a rather fine bottle of red wine. But I'm
lovely.
In tier three, so I'm unable to bring it to you. So I will drink it. And as I raise the first glass...
Raise a glass to me, Phil.
I'll mention your name.
Well, I'll do the same. If I can find a nice bottle of red wine, I'll do exactly the same for you. How about that?
Good stuff. Well, happy Christmas and have a great new year. And everyone listening to us, once again, thank you. We, from David and I, we wish you all a very merry Christmas. And we hope that 2021, when we speak to you again, will prove to be the start of things better and healthier.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk.